Hello, Maya Lau here, and thanks for tuning into Other People's Pockets. Don't forget that we'd love to hear from you at otherpeoplespockets@gmail.com about your thoughts on the show, suggestions for guests, or anything else. And please subscribe or follow this podcast on whichever podcast app you use, and give us a rating and a review, and tell a friend about it. All of it helps support this show.
Therapists have to work on their own issues of we're just supposed to do our good work and not talk about money and not strive for money and not talk about money.
See no money, know? Hear you no know? Money.
Exactly. Yeah, just like somehow we're living off the grid in an ashram, right?
Have you ever thought about how money shows up in your body or what your unconscious money beliefs are or how to heal your relationship with money? These are all questions that my guest, Barry Tesler, is going to teach us about. She's a financial therapist and the author of The Art of Money, a life-changing guide to financial happiness. Barry trained as a psychotherapist before taking a detour into becoming a bookkeeper. And while that may seem random, she discovered that the combination of money management and therapy could be a whole new career path for her. Now, she works with people to heal their money wounds and create a better approach to their finances, not just through spreadsheets, but also through listening to the body and getting to the root of why we have money anxiety in the first place. And by the way, in the interview, Barry mentions she went to Naropa, which refers to Naropa University in Colorado. I'm Maya Lau, and this is Other People's Pockets, the show where I ask people how much they make and how their finances work, so the questions we all have about money can be a little bit less of a mystery. Barry, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
How did you become interested in this intersection between money and therapy?
I always like to say that when I was growing up, there were three things that I wanted to be when I grew up. Number one was a solid gold dancer. And you may be too young to get that reference. On TV, it was these fabulous dancers that wore gold. They were known as solid gold dancers. You can look it up. Okay. So in the 70s, this was, you know, an amazing thing that I wanted to be. I was a dancer. Second thing is I wanted to be a businesswoman. Why? Because my dad was in business. I didn't know what kind of business. I wrote my seventh grade career report on, I want to be a businesswoman. The third thing was when I was 16, I asked my parents if I could go to therapy. I was enjoying being a 16-year-old. I was pretty wild. But at the same time, I was having lots of angst and anger and sadness and all the typical teenager things. And I wanted to understand myself better. So my parents sent me to therapy. They unfortunately sent me to a male therapist and a talk therapist, which wasn't a good fit for a teenage girl. And I wound up playing a lot of games with this therapist and we didn't really get anywhere. But it was a great first step. So those three things led me to, you know, what happened after I finished my undergraduate degree. I got that degree in history, went to University of Wisconsin at Madison, left that school, had no idea what I wanted to be still or do with my life. Everyone around me was getting six-figure marketing jobs. And I just was sitting there just frozen. You know, I had no idea. So I took a year off. My father wanted me to go to Japan. I had been learning Japanese a few summers. He wanted me to teach English, come back learning Japanese and work with him in business. I was very close to doing that at the last hour. I said, I'm not doing that, Dad. That's your plan, not mine. And I'm going to Israel to find out more about my lineage. And that's what I'm doing. And I think he said something like, you're making the biggest mistake in your life, you know. And, you know, when I was in Israel, I just had a flash of insight that I was going to merge my dance background with my love for psychology and therapy and put it together. And I thought I made up dance movement therapy. I thought I made up this entire field. And soon after that, I get to Jerusalem and then hear that there's graduate programs in dance movement therapy, somatic psychology, and then came to Naropa at the age of 24 to start my master's degree in somatic psychology. And then spent the next 4 years steeped in training to be a therapist. And they require you to be in therapy, individual therapy, group therapy. It was essential. I, you know, graduated and my school loan came due. I flipped out. We never talked about money in my graduate school program. We're training to be therapists. We're studying every single topic under the sun, beyond the sun, and we're never talking about money. So we're not learning what money emotions come up for us. What are our money stories? How do we work with our couples when they're fighting about money? Let alone, how do we start a private practice with the bookkeeping and
pricing? Right, because most therapists become solo business owners close to it. So it's, it is kind of crazy that they wouldn't talk to you about that very, like, oh, this is actually how you are going to practice. That's so funny that that didn't come up.
It didn't come up at all. There was no training. There was no courses, nothing. And so that was a moment where I realized I'm not going to go running away. I'm going to face it like I do every other big, scary topic in my life. And I'm going to start learning every single thing I can. And also at the time, the mental health program asked me if I wanted to take 5 hours out of those 40 and they would teach me Quicken. I was still throwing away my bank statements at that time. I mean, what do you do with them? I don't know.
Right.
And so, but I said yes. And I wound up learning Quicken. And I wound up taking a job in an accounting department, learning bookkeeping for $13. And then they bumped me up to 15 and then 20. You know, once you get going. And I realized what I started doing was I learned how to do my own bookkeeping and track my own numbers, which was incredible and brought so much mindfulness. But then I decided I wasn't ready to be a therapist. I had no idea how to run a business. So from the ages of 28 to 32, I ran a bookkeeping business for other therapists and artists, and they just threw their books at me. They had no idea I had a master's in psychology. They didn't want anything to do with this. And I learned so much about people's relationship to money, from how they spent their money to their income patterns, to their cash flow patterns, to their spending patterns. I could see so much by looking at their books and keeping their books. And then it was at the age of 32 where all of a sudden I realized it was time to merge all of my therapy training with all of these practical money management tools that I was surprisingly falling in love with and put them together. And then that's when my first financial therapies, to answer your question in a long way, that's when I had a mentor that said, I want you to give a talk on your work. And I was like, what are you talking about? You know? And she's like, you're going to give a talk. And I went out into the woods and I was like, how can I help people have a healthy, creative, savvy, confident, conscious relationship to money? This was almost 25 years ago. And I came running back home from the woods, and my husband and I were living in a tiny cabin in the Redwoods in California. We threw up white paper, and we basically came up with my three-phase methodology that I'm still using now 22 years later. And he is the one who named it. He said, you are doing financial therapy. And it was like, ding, ding, ding. All the light bulbs went on. I went online. One other person in Canada was using that term. And I just...
I was going to ask if that was a thing or...
It wasn't a thing. It's become a whole thing. It wasn't, you know? So I have to give my husband credit for that. He's an amazing namer. And, you know, it all came to be. And I gave that talk. And then I just started teaching my financial therapy methodology in tiny little groups of 10 people over and over and over in my living room. And then it grew to 20 people, and then it grew to 50, and then it grew to 500. But it was, you know, I would teach it over and over and over to see what was working, what I missed, and just to keep fine tuning my three phases, which are money healing, money practices, and money maps.
What is the feedback you would get from people? Is there anything that surprised you? Like maybe your approach to money therapy is not quite what worked for some people, or what kind of feedback were you getting from people?
Well, you know, one of the first things I did, I'll just tell you, one of the first nights I gathered people in my living room and I think I went right to, tell me your family of origin money story. Like I went right to it, you know, and I could see that there was big emotion happening. There was some fight, flight, freeze happening. And I realized, whoa, 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 whoa. We need to slow this down. Number one. Number two, what am I thinking not bringing my somatic tools into this work? And the very next time I led it, or I think the very next class, I said, now we're going to learn something called the body check-in. And this is just stopping and pausing and noticing what's happening in your body on a physical level, sensation level. Where's your breathing? How shallow? How deep? You know, where is it in your body? And then I always end a body check-in, which is now called resourcing. That comes from Peter Levine's work. But back in the day, I just called it finish your body check-in with one little moment of making an adjustment so that you feel okay in your body. You know, what is one little adjustment you can make? Loosening your jaw, lowering your shoulders, doing a little shoulder shimmy, seeing if you can take a deeper breath. And so that's one little practice that I brought from my somatic background. And I have people do this. I invite people to do this before you're going to make a money decision, before you're going to do some online shopping, before you're going to look at your numbers, while you're going to look at your numbers.
And you've mentioned the word several times, somatic.
Yeah.
For people that don't understand what that is, can you explain what that is?
Soma, body, just means our mind and our body is connected. My first therapy experience was with a talk therapist. And why I personally needed somatic therapy was, one, when I was a teenager, I would go into my room, put on music, and dance out every emotion, anger, sadness. I would come out of my room and then be able to articulate what was actually going on for me. Before that, I couldn't. Mm-hmm. So I knew that my body had a lot of information. I knew I processed things through my body, through movement, through dance. And I also know that as a woman, as a human, we're taught to ignore our body and to not listen to our body. So when I was 22, 23, and I started hearing that there was somatic therapy and something called authentic movement, and that it would teach you to slow down and listen to your body again and listen to your messages, it was just mind-blowing for me. And I think is what saved me during my 20s because it gave me life skills. Mm-hmm. But here, what somatic therapy is simply you're in a session with someone and you're not just listening to their words. You're also noticing what their facial expressions are. You're noticing what their shoulders are doing, what their body is doing, what their breathing is doing. Now, I can't interpret that for you. I'm going to invite you to notice it for yourself and to see what you're noticing or what you're learning or what's coming up for you, right? My shoulders, when they're up high, mean something for me, different than what it means for you. So somatic therapy is just that we store a lot in our body. Our body has a lot of memories, good, bad, beautiful, challenging. And it's really important to not just, you know, do therapy with someone's mind and intellect, but it's really important to get them into their body, into their sensations, into their emotions and memories in that way. And to learn that this can be a safe place, that our body can be a safe place. And that there's just so much here to learn about, you know, and to follow in our lives and in our relationship to money.
Yeah. And I think I recently had a therapist who really just got me to stop talking. Like, I can talk and analyze and explain away how I'm feeling, and I can do that like at warp speed. And she was like, stop. Like, let your body catch up. Your body's slower. It's not caught up yet. And I just stopped and like felt my feelings and just started crying. And I was like, I don't know why I'm feeling this. And I think, yeah, it is so important to like, it's hard for me to tap into my body. Like when someone says, where do you feel that in your body? I'm like,
what are you talking about?
Yes. What do you mean? Well, that's such a random question, you know?
Right. After we do some of the money motion work, the money story work, I was then jumping into, now let's learn a bookkeeping system. And some other methodologies have you jump right to set up a bookkeeping system first. Mm. And I always thought, because of my training as a somatic therapist and therapist, we have to do some of the deeper work first. Mm. One, I don't want you to stay in therapy forever. I don't want, you know, but yes, let's go back and pick up some of the pieces, some of the wounds, some of the bones, you know, some of the places where you made some of those declarations about money or life that aren't working anymore. And learn some tools of how to get in their body, how to notice that when you arrive at the bookkeeping system, you're more ready. Mm-hmm. So I realized that people were still learning their current relationship to earning and spending and saving, but there was still this missing piece because they were still going to sleep at night feeling shame about past money mistakes. And so I learned from, this is one of the things I learned from doing those groups, is wait a second, we need some support and tools for how to have compassion for our previous money mistakes. Because guess what? Everyone I know has made some kind of money mistakes. How do we bring love and compassion to who we were at that time? And guess what? It makes perfect sense why we did money in that way, or we made that decision, or we made those so-called money mistakes. I don't even like calling them money mistakes. It's just, that's where we were in our relationship to money. We still, there was a lot of things we didn't know.
How much money do you make?
I like how you just like ask the interview. Okay. So, you know, I have to give context to this.
That's fine.
Just blurting out your number without context, I do think it would
be. It can be reductive.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So when I was first starting out, I told you I was making $2,000 with a master's degree. Then when I was a bookkeeper,
$2,000
a month.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, $2,000. I added a third job of overnight care and I got it up to $3,000, right? Then I started a bookkeeping business. My first year made $28,000. Then I moved to $50,000 the next year. Then I
per year. Okay.
Then I started teaching my small groups and I wanted to stop my bookkeeping. And so the next year I did lots of groups and I made $50,000 in my little living room, you know? And then it grew to 90,000, and then it grew to 180, and then it grew to 250. And then I had my son. And we had a huge complication during the birth. My placenta abrupted. And we luckily, both of us made it through. I always like have to stop myself from crying in that moment. And like, I thought I'd just like be gung-ho with my business. I needed to recover. And I was like, you know, turned 40 and was in love with my son and wanted to be with him full time, and went from like 50, 60 hours a week because I just had the energy in my 30s to now what can I do in 10 hours? What can I do that I love the most that brings in a decent amount of income? And I think I did two groups that year and brought in 75,000. And then when my son started sleeping again, that's when I opened it.
Which was when?
At 3 years old. At three.
Okay, yeah, I have a three-year-old right now, and we have gone in and out of sleeping through the night her whole life.
Yes. Yeah, it was at three. I'm with you, right? All of a sudden, I was like, I can think again.
Currently not sleeping.
Okay, yes. It's coming. It's coming. I promise you it is. It is. So impressive that you're doing this. And so at three is when that's when I had the clarity to ask new questions about my work and program. And that's when I went from, you know, the 50 students to 320 and brought in 250,000 in that two-month registration period. And so for a while, I was bringing in about 400, 450,000. And my overhead has always been around 30%.
Mm-hmm. What's your net worth?
I'm not going to answer that one. And okay. I'll tell you why.
Sure.
Because I'm still figuring that out. I mean, it's not something that I literally like track and go to. Yes, we have a home. And I'm happy to tell you the price of my home. I can tell you a few things and you can probably add it up, but I did not come from a wealthy family. My family was middle class. All my grandparents escaped from what is now Ukraine. My parents were first generation. I'm second generation. Grew up in Chicago. So I'm not sitting on millions, right, with family wealth. But my father insisted he was middle class. And I would say, are you sure you're not middle upper class? And he would be like, no, I'm middle class. And I'm going to spend all my money and you're not going to get a penny of it. And my mom would say, I would love to pass down some money to my kids. it would be the first time in our family that that would have happened. And she has passed down some money, right? Like when you can do the $10,000 gift, you know, over the last few years, she's done that. When we went to go buy a home in Boulder, Colorado, which is a very pricey place, and we spent quite a few years like, should we move somewhere else? And we wound up finding a home that was $675,000. It's a townhome, a very tall, like five-level, narrow townhome. So oh, wow. My mom mm-hmm. did give us $50,000, and my husband's mom gave us $20,000. So we did get family money in that moment, and were able to buy a home mm-hmm. that's gone up. I mean, in Boulder, it's now valued at $1 million, which I think is just ridiculous, or it was up to $1.1 million, insane. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we have our home, and we just bought a little plot of land in Taos, and mm-hmm. where we want to move to after our son heads off into the big world, where he'll come with us. And then my husband's family has a cottage from his great-grandparents on Lake Michigan. So middle-class roots with some extra stuff.
Do you think that there's anything about being a financial therapist that pays more than other types of therapy that one could do?
I've never been asked that question. I think that, you know, it's a niche, and it's become a whole field that's growing and budding. You know, in 2001, barely anyone was using this term. And then in 2006, mm-hmm. the Financial Therapy Association was created. I'm not a part mm-hmm. of that association. I'm on good terms with them. We talk sometimes, but I was already doing this. And, you know, I'm like,
yeah, you're like,
I'm already doing this. So. I don't want to be under their auspice. I don't want to be under this. So, but it's now becoming a whole field, right? Therapists have to work on their own issues of we're just supposed to do our good work and not talk about money and not strive mm-hmm. for money and not talk about
see
money.
See no money, hear know, no money. You know, yeah.
Exactly. Just like somehow we're living off the grid in an ashram, right? And right? But yeah, financial therapy and therapists do charge more. We do. A lot of people charge $200 $250 an hour. That's why I wanted to do groups, because it was more accessible.
Bring down the cost. And, yes. and why? So why are financial therapists able to charge more? Is it because it's this niche, or is it because there's something about like money that people are willing to pay more because you're going to help them with their money, you know, which is so important, and maybe they'll make more money after this or something?
Yeah, people charge more if they're a business coach, if they're teaching you about your business. So you can even charge more if you're teaching people make more money in their businesses or doing that kind of coaching. Yeah, I guess people feel like you get a return on investment if someone's teaching you how yeah. to earn more.
You mentioned being middle class before. Do you, what socioeconomic class do you consider yourself now?
I think I'm upper middle class, but I need to find this one very detailed. It said, if you're middle class, you can pay for everything, but when you start having more than one property, then you start inching your way up to upper middle class somewhere. Mm. And it was so nuanced. They do a lot of really good work with families who are wealthy and have passed down money for many generations. And the younger folks, the white younger folks, are wanting to redistribute those resources mm-hmm. anywhere from 10 to 90%. And, you know, I do interviews yeah. on all the macro stuff, like, hey, what's social justice investing? Or, hey, if you're a younger person who comes from a family of wealth and you want to pass some of it on, right? What do you do? Right. So I'm pretty sure it came mm-hmm. from them. It was either.
Mm-hmm. I think I know what you're talking about, and I'm yeah. forgetting the name yeah. as well. But I interviewed this woman named Mary O'Hara, who's a writer and an expert on class. And money and social affairs. And she was just making this great point that, like, class is really not just about money. Like, there's these sort of, like, literal definitions. And she talked about interclasses. Like, there's this bleeding Venn diagram of mixtures of kind of different classes. I just thought that was so interesting.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. You know, I've asked other people, like, how do you identify? Tell me more of your family and your heritage and what class you came from. But no, you're the first person to ask me, like, what class? And I usually say I came from a middle-class family, but no one asked me to talk about that in a more nuanced way.
I think that's part of the salary transparency conversation that I at least don't feel like it's talked about enough. I think that, you know, I'm obviously all for transparency, and there's also very real emotions that can come up when you compare yourself to others and you hear the reality and it's like, oh, wow, like you yes. make that much, like that makes yes. me feel like shit or whatever. And I'm just wondering, do you have any thoughts on, I guess I'd call it like the unintended consequences of salary transparency. Like yeah. it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just a thing. It's a thing that can happen. And
great
do you have any thoughts on?
Of course. Okay.
Yeah.
So one, you know, the New York Times just put out a piece last week where they interviewed people on the street and just said, how much money do you make? Right.
Yeah.
I sent it right to my husband going, look at this. And I looked through the entire thing. I mean, were there 50 different people in there? I don't know. It was amazing. Right.
A lot.
And people
yeah.
were all
yeah.
over the place. And I just said and read it. And yeah, I watched my own reactions like, ooh, that's a lot, or wow, they should be making more, or right? So, but it's normal, mm-hmm. right? It's normal to see that or hear that. And I would say, please go to a body check-in, okay? And be gentle, mm-hmm. like, right? So when people first go to a body check-in, they're like, I don't need to do that. I know I get overwhelmed. I know I freak out. I know I get angry. I know I get sad. Okay, let yourself really be curious. Let yourself slow down for a moment. Let yourself just be a little more compassionate to self and let yourself just notice what's going on in your body as you're hearing some of these interviews, you know, and you're hearing other people's salary and income. What do you notice? What sensations are coming up for you? What emotions are coming up for you? What is your breath doing? Where is it in your body? You know, and then end with like, is there any little adjustment that I can make where I can tap into okayness for me in this moment, right? Then after that, yeah, then ask your questions. Like, what am I learning from this? Am I horrified that they get paid so much? What does this remind me of? What expectations do I have of them because I know how much they make now, right? Like, oh, they should be donating this much or redistributing resources this much or the, you know.
Or they should be doing their job so much better.
Exactly. Or damn the culture in what it values and what it doesn't, you know. I still go through that. You don't, I still compare. I have people and friends that came from a lot of family wealth. You know, years ago when someone was buying a home locally way before we could, and she said, oh, but I'm not getting any family money. I was like, well, you're getting the down payment. She's like, yeah, but it's only $300,000, you know? And I'm like, for her, that was like, that's not family money. And I was like, oh my God, you know? Like, I would love that. Yeah. I don't have that. And I feel bad that I don't. And I wish that. And that sucks. And she sucks. And, you know, like.
Or you judge her for saying what she said. Like, yeah, yeah. A friend, I think very lovingly and jokingly in response to the first few episodes of my podcast, she said, Maya, stop making me feel poor. And I feel that. I wouldn't want anyone to feel that from listening to the show. And at the same time, I realize that probably any money amounts we talk about, there's somebody out there that is going to feel like that's ridiculous, you know? And that, yeah, that just these are real things. As we talk about money, it can be very cathartic. It can also be very raw, and it can hurt a little bit. And it can be like, I did not need to know that, or whatever. You know, it's just these are hard conversations, and it's hard to hear.
And they can bring up so much, and they will. And we just have to keep coming back to ourselves. Similar to like in my 20s when I was watching my friends get those six-figure marketing jobs. And I was like, how are they doing that? You know, but I was also like, I would never want a marketing job. And that's not my thing. So we have to keep coming back to who we are, who we're not, what we're good at, what we suck at. And it's so important to always really be aware of what phase of life that we're in, what age, that we all hit milestones at different points. You know, I bought my first home at the age of 46. My friends are buying homes in their 20s. There's always 3 to 5 things that we're doing well around money. You know, I tip well. I'm a good, you know, gift giver. I, you know, whatever it is, I raised my son until he was in his 20s and he's a good man. And yes, I have a lot of debt, but always taking some time to identify what you're doing well around money, where you're at, appreciate that, knowing that there's always more goals on the horizon. There's always things to get to, and try to create our work and money and life around that.
Barry, thank you so much for talking to me. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to Other People's Pockets. If you like the show, please tell a friend and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Word of mouth and reviews really help us out. Other People's Pockets is written and hosted by me, Maya Lau. It's produced by me along with Joy Sanford and Dan Gallucci. Production help from Angela Vang. Our executive producers are me along with Jane Marie and Dan Gallucci. A special thanks to Somatic Therapy. Other People's Pockets is a co-production of Pushkin Industries and Little Everywhere. To find more Pushkin podcasts, listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you love this show, consider subscribing to Pushkin Plus, offering bonus content and ad-free listening across our network for $4.99 a month. Look for the Pushkin Plus channel on Apple Podcasts or at pushkin.fm. You can sign up for Pushkin newsletters at pushkin.fm. Find me on Twitter at Maya Lau or on Instagram and TikTok at It's Maya Money. And we would love to hear your voices. This week, we want to know, what is the question that makes you squirm the most when it comes to your money? Leave us a voicemail at 323-540-4255. That's 323-540-4255. Or record a voice memo and send it to otherpeoplespockets@gmail.com.
Feel your best and amplify your everyday look with Thrive Cosmetics. Go to thrivecosmetics.com/shine26 for an exclusive offer of 20% off your first order. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS.com/shine26.